Star Walker Studios presents Star Citizens United, a podcast dedicated to making the most of the future hit PC video game, Star Citizen. Greetings, citizen, and welcome to the Star Citizens United podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. Today, I discuss the Rilla, Riemann, and Baker star systems. Hello, citizen. Welcome to episode 24 of Star Citizens United. Thank you so much for flying with me today. So this episode, I am continuing with my exploration of the bountiful lore of Star Citizen. There is so much already to explore, and we don't even have the persistent universe yet, but there's a lot of great information on the Robert Space Industries website, but it takes a lot of time to go through, and we're all really busy, and a lot of us don't have a lot of time to sit at a computer or sit at our phone or our tablet and just pour over the website. So for you pilots on the go out there, I am making these lore episodes. So you can listen to these while you're driving your car or exercising or whatever you need to do. Maybe even at work if you're lucky enough to be able to listen to podcasts while you're on the job. So I really enjoy doing these. This is something that I would do for myself personally, going through all this information. And as I started reading all this great stuff on the website, it occurred to me that it would be great to share it with you. So that's what I'm doing. I started out with the writer's guides, and now we're going through the galactic guides on the site. And the galactic guides, in case you don't know, actually come from the jump point issues. So if you really dig this lore stuff and you want to dig in even more to the lore of this game, consider becoming a subscriber over at Robert Space Industries, and then you get the Jump Point magazine, which I believe comes out every month. It's a digital magazine that has a lot more stuff in it. And I am assuming, I don't know for sure because I am not a subscriber myself, but I am assuming that there's even more lore in there than what we see as non-subscribers. But they do occasionally release some of this information from Jump Point in the form of these galactic guides. And that's what I've been doing in season two. Speaking of which, I am very close to wrapping up season two of the show. The season two finale episode will be next week, episode 25. And unlike after the last season, I am going to take a break. So season one went right into season two. There wasn't really much downtime between them, but I have just powered through these galactic guides. There's not a lot of them left. Honestly, definitely not enough for a whole season. And I'm kind of at the moment a little lost as to what to do next. There are already a lot of great Star Citizen podcasts out there and YouTube channels, and there's all kinds of fan-created Star Citizen stuff. And I don't want to just do what someone else is doing. I want to have my own unique angle on things. And honestly, it's fairly limited what you can do when the game isn't even out yet, right? So once the game is out and we're all playing it, I'm sure I will be able to find my own unique spot in the Star Citizen universe of fandom that's out there. But until then, other than doing these lore episodes, I'm a little lost as to what else to do. So if you have any ideas, feel free to let me know at scupodcast@gmail.com. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a little break before season three. I will be back for season three, so this isn't signing off forever. But I'm going to take a break, let us build up some more galactic guides to talk about, maybe some other sources of lore to talk about, wait for lightning to strike my brain. Another thing that is coming that we can look forward to is the first chapter of Squadron 42. And I don't know how much content that is going to be, how many hours of gameplay it's going to be to get through that one chapter. I also don't know how long it will be after that before chapter 2 comes out, So if you know any of those things, let me know at scupodcast@gmail.com. But I'm hoping that maybe when Squadron 42 starts coming out, that there will be enough meat in this game that I can really start digging into more in-game stuff and talking about that. But we'll see. So this week, I am going to be talking about three star systems and digging into those. Again, those are coming from Galactic Guides on the Robert Space Industries website. I will have links directly to those articles in my show notes for this episode, episode 24, at starwalkerstudios.com. So head on over there and follow those links if you want to follow along. Our first star system today is the Rilla system. Rilla, a Xi'an word meaning source of strength, is a former military bastion located one jump beyond the Perry Line. The Xi'an established their solar presences with singular goals, and Rilla's initial industrial focus is no exception. With the rise of the human threat, Rilla was converted into a major staging area for Xi'an military forces, and the system's two worlds were initially terraformed with only this purpose in mind. Massive barracks facilities, training yards, and munitions plants initially populated the system. If the Xi'an Empire had ever gone into all-out war with Earth, Rilla would have been a key strategic launch point. Today, however, Rilla is a star example of the thawing of relations between the Xi'an and human empires. With the increase in trade and other relations between the powers, the ready-made invasion force has been withdrawn and Rilla has been formally redistricted into its original purpose as an industrial zone. The conversion and the integration of humans on the system's planets have had an interesting effect and resulted in a particularly unique place for human visitors to explore. Sounds cool. Cosmologically, Rilla is an A4 main sequence star with a thick green band capable of supporting a pair of large ecosystems. Jump points lead to both human and Xi'an worlds, although the latter are kept uncharted on all official maps. While the bulk of the fighting force has been withdrawn from Rilla, a well-trained border defense force remains, making it an inopportune point for smugglers hoping to break into Xi'an space. The first three planets in the system are largely unremarkable. Rilla 1 is a rocky, star-swept protoplanet incapable of supporting any known form of life. Rilla 2 is a puffy planet, an unusually close-in gas giant with a large radius but very low density. Due to this and its proximity to the star, Rilla 2 is not an effective refueling station. Oh, that's pretty cool. I'd like to know more about that gas giant being so close to the star. Rilla 3 is an Earth-sized world with a rapid daily orbit. With a very thin atmosphere and a surface of dense, jagged rock, Rilla 3 is an unlikely candidate for terraformation. The fourth planet in the Rilla system, called Shervu, was terraformed by the Xi'an Empire as a barracks world, dotted with facilities to train and house military ground forces, as well as mid-range weapons factories capable of equipping them. With the drawdown of the last century, the military factories of Shervu have been methodically dismantled and replaced with corporate industrial zones, the very sight of which is a fascinating process, as massive Xi'an-driven mechanical ants strip structures and other objects back into their component materials. Now that is something I'd like to see in-game. Today, the conversion into an industrial world is nearly complete, although there remain scars of the former military occupation everywhere. Xi'an corporations have moved to Shervu in force. Unlike most Xi'an worlds, humans are encouraged to visit Shervu via a landau in the industrial complex at Yati, a former troop training megapolis. This was a calculated decision on the part of the Xi'an governance. Corporations needing to interact with humans are given tax breaks to establish offices in Yati, keeping human intrusion into Xi'an space to an absolute minimum. The result is a corporate office park with outlets occupied by the big players, from shipbuilders like Misk Xi'an and Alpoa all the way to food processing companies and simple import-export barristers. The culture is an interesting mash. Many of these outlets hire mostly human staff, but insist on traditional Xi'an customs and methods of interaction. The industrial regions surrounding Yati are largely human-centric. Any cartual purchased will travel through a line near Yati, and several MISC-overseen factories pump out Xi'an-acclimatized models of the Hull D. Shervu also buys outside goods to fuel their industrial development. Heavy metals as well as a variety of electronics are in demand here, and the population has become acclimatized to purchasing these from human transports where necessary. Called Z by the natives, Rilla 5 is technically classified as a Xi'an habitation world. A natural super-Earth, Z is a temperate planet roughly 3.5 times the size of mankind's home world. Like any Xi'an-focused planet, Z's dedication to a single task has produced ultra-ordered results unlike anything you might find orbiting a human star. Estimates suggest that between 50 and 100 billion Xi'an inhabit the stacked life spheres that form the basis for the world's dozens of massive cityscapes. The exception is Corolla, a smaller city surrounded by dense tropical rainforest. Open to outsiders, Corolla has become a de facto trading post where interested Xi'an can interact with human, Banu, and Tavaran shipmasters. Over the years, Corolla has become home to a distinct community of UEE expatriates and political refugees who have begun to subtly merge their distinct human culture amidst the city's standard Xi'an hab world architecture. UEE law enforcement has no jurisdiction in Xi'an space, and so it has become a popular place to hide in plain sight. However, do note that the Xi'an typically do not prosecute human-on-human crimes, making this an open port for more ruthless bounty hunters. There you go. Visitors are warned not to try and explore other regions of the planet for both sociological and practical reasons. In the case of the former, Xi'an culture remains extremely xenophobic, and humans are absolutely not welcome in settlements beyond Corolla. Anyone caught in another settlement will be treated as an infiltrator, and the UEE government has shown little interest in expending clout to save the lives of wayward tourists taken in such instances. Additionally, it is generally impossible to simply walk out of Corolla. The settlements surrounding rainforests are impassable and are stocked with a variety of toxic plants and deadly animals. Chief among these is the fearsome all-tongued Rilla jump beast. From the surface of Rilla 6, the system's distant dwarf worldlet, the light from Rilla's star is barely visible. This is not, of course, something the typical traveler would ever experience. Rilla 6 is a lonely world, void of atmosphere, resources, landing zones, or any interest whatsoever. It is wholly unnoteworthy, save for the persistent space rumor that the planet is home to a Xi'an tripwire capable of autonomously placing the Empire on a war footing. The claim, wholly unsubstantiated, goes that the technology is left over from Rilla's days as a fortified border system, and that the technology remains active, buried in Rilla 6's core to this day. No rumor clearly identifies what the tripwire is, with claims ranging from the central computer that controls a massive space network of scanners to some sort of doomsday device capable of destroying the planet and anyone caught investigating it. Next up on our tour of the galaxy is the Bremen system. Bremen rightly claims to be the smallest star system with the biggest impact on galactic affairs. For just over 5 centuries, Bremen and its unassuming planet of Rytif have been surprisingly important elements in everything from intergalactic warfare to the overthrow of the Messer regime. Today, it has surprised the galaxy yet again by becoming a wholly unexpected center for the high-tech spacecraft industry. A K-type main-sequence star located at the outer reaches of Charon's Nebula, Bremen was first visited by the legendary for-profit explorer Bao Yun in 2441. Yun's crew charted the star's 4 worlds, identified the only green-band terraforming candidate as unremarkable, and promptly sold his spotter's rights to the United Nations of Earth. The UNE Expansion Council marked Bremen for development, and standard terraforming of Rytif soon followed. Within two decades, the system was ready for a slow influx of human settlers. While most homesteaders were attracted to risky, resource-rich systems, Bremen was seen as a safe alternative by some. Then, at the dawn of the 27th century, man found himself again making war on aliens. With the Second Tavaran War in full swing, the burgeoning United Empire of Earth was in great need of dependable resources to support the conflict against Korthal's armadas. With the core worlds focusing on producing ships and weapons, the UEE reached out to its more distant colonies. Aiming to both incorporate these worlds in the war effort and to take some of the burden off the overtaxed planets closer to home, planners were surprised to discover that Bremen 2's ecosystem was uniquely capable of growing low perishable foodstuffs. In a matter of months, Bremen was outputting the majority of food provided to UEE military units on the front. The population skyrocketed as speculators arrived to purchase farmland, and many of the timid original colonists found themselves millionaires several times over. For 7 years of war and an ensuing two decades of peace, Bremen's farms, packagers, and shipping facilities have been an economic powerhouse like nowhere else in the industry. By 2640, however, the system's population had again begun to dwindle. Humanity's fortune was on the rise, and the newly fortified empire now craved more variety than Bremen's simple sustenance could offer. The planet seemed to be resigned to the dustbin of history, its part in a popular war nothing more than a footnote. Ultimately, it was exactly Bremen's return to its prior unassuming status that led to its most important role yet. In 2792, anti-Messer activists began using Bremen as an operation hub to organize the overthrow of the regime. Revolutionary-minded expats who had previously escaped to the Xian Empire were smuggled back to launch their conspiracy from Bremen. The extent of Bremen's role in the overthrow of the Messer government remained a secret to the general populace until the Senate released declassified communications between resistance members within the government and the revolutionaries on the planet. It was this evidence that directly led to the planet's official recognition just 5 years ago. Today, Bremen is home to a growing aerospace industry instigated by Silas Korner, a descendant of the system's most wealthy original homesteader and his Consolidated Outland Group. And I talked about Consolidated Outland last week. Bremen has become the first outer world to produce a complete spacecraft, with thousands of Mustangs flying off the assembly lines every day. With a rich history and a variety of natural resources at hand, Bremen seems set to remain something of an unexpected powerhouse in the modern post-Messer Empire. The first planet in the Bremen system was described in only four words in Baoyun's survey, a small dead rock. The ensuing centuries have not added significantly to Bremen 1's mystique, and there is no proliferation of minerals or other resources that make visiting the planet profitable. The rock has, however, become something of a legend among modern explorers, leaving Bremen for parts unknown. It's now a tradition among many to tip your wings towards Bremen 1 while within visual range of the planet for good luck before setting off on a long-distance run. Breadbasket, Forge of the Revolution and high-tech headquarters, Bremen 2, formerly recognized as Rytif, is the planet that has won so many hats. Rytif is currently home to Consolidated Outland's growing starship empire, and it is the personal home of the company's eccentric founder. The recent discovery of subsurface mineral deposits, combined with the planet's long history of agriculture, means that Rytif is a rare, self-sufficient, terraformed world that can theoretically exist without any interstellar commerce. In reality, Rytif is anything but an isolated world, with the popularity of the Mustang line bringing trade from around the galaxy. Despite the planet's storied history and recent popularity, Rytif settlements retain a small-town sensibility. Visitors are usually directed to Stalford, a mid-sized city located just north of the equator. Stalford has long been the farming headquarters of the planet, with water farms and commercial vivariums ringing its surrounding hills. A variety of tourist-centric monuments to the role of the planet in the fall of the Messers have sprung up in the last 5 years, and tourism also seems poised for a growth spurt. Bremen 3 is a coreless world located well outside the system's green band, beyond any reasonable hope of terraformation. Bremen 3 was home to a reasonable amount of mineral resources upon the system's discovery, but it was quickly strip mined clear to support the development of Bremen 2. Today, there is little reason to approach Bremen 3, although the same was said of Rytef itself in the years before its involvement in the overthrow. Considered by locals to be the star's guardian planet for its role in keeping comets clear of the inner worlds, Bremen 4 is a massive ice giant. This swirling mass of hydrogen and other gases is interspersed with variable fields of ice, making for a particularly beautiful planetscape. Unfortunately, raw refueling operations at Bremen 4 are nigh impossible, owing to the lack of clear gas fields. It is not uncommon to find the wreckage of stubborn starfarers or caterpillars that have attempted this in decay orbits around the world. Finally today, I will discuss the Baker system, which is a binary system consisting of two K-type main sequence stars surrounded by a relatively desolate collection of planets that range from completely uninhabitable to barely habitable. A Kovalec shipping hub and a largely automated mining outpost are the sole bastions of civilization in the region. As usual, that's only half the story though. The Baker system is also home to the Abel Baker Challenge, arguably underground racing's most dangerous event. Baker's claim to fame is twofold. It is one of the only binary star systems in the United Empire of Earth that is technically inhabited, and it lies just a single jump from the breadbasket of Terra. The first point has earned the system the attention of a large number of astrophysicists eager to study such a star setup within the confines of safe and patrolled space. The second is the reason for both the system's high point of civilization, the shipping hub, and for its use as an underground racing arena. Baker and the surrounding cluster were first charted in 2508 by the same expedition that first identified Terra. While Terra was reached and explored soon after the region was charted, Baker remained forgotten due to the fact that binary stars traditionally offer little of value to humans. Even when a planet within a binary star's green zone can be terraformed, the gravitic stress associated with passing close to or even between two stars renders attempts at civilization a moot point. The first successful jump transit to Baker occurred in 2676, well after Terra had become established as a major player in galactic politics. The jump point to Baker was discovered by accident in the outer reaches of the Terra system, and Baker was subsequently explored by a purely scientific expedition. Formal territorial commerce rights were awarded to the Terran government, which has quietly partitioned them out to Terra-based concerns. From a settlement or resources standpoint, Baker's first three worlds were written off immediately after the system was charted. None can be terraformed in a fashion that will sustain life permanently, and none have resources that make traveling close to the system's stars worthwhile. Baker 1 is a small planet with a dense iron core that is in a dangerously close orbit around Baker's two suns. This proximity leads to an unstable orbital trajectory, and scientists posit that its orbit will steadily decay until it is subsumed by the larger star within the next 150 million years. Baker 2 is a typical smog planet, a sickly yellow-green worldlet with a dense and highly poisonous atmosphere. While not significantly crushed by the star's gravity during its rotation, Baker 2's atmosphere is so unsupportive of human life that terraforming has never been a serious option here. In fact, the toxic mix is also incredibly corrosive to standard spacecraft hulls. The planet made headlines recently when a freelancer piloted by suspected gunrunners attempted to hide out at Baker 2, only to find their ship literally dissolving out from under their feet. Baker 3 is an ice giant, a churning mass of white with deep blue veins. The planet's circumference has increased noticeably since its discovery, something astrophysicists are keeping a watchful eye on. Xenia is a Kovalec shipping hub constructed to support the burgeoning shipping industry in the Terra system. Xenia has expanded by leaps and bounds with the realization that operating through the station allows merchants to avoid the increasingly high tariffs associated with moving goods through Terra-based facilities. The station itself has grown into a series of prefab habitation facilities, joining together cargo bays to form a ring. These bays range from pressurized hangars for smaller ships to massive vacuum wet docks capable of servicing the largest freighter designs. Larger ships flying under Kovalik's registry and carrying bulk goods typically disperse their cargo at Xenia, where private enterprise crews can pick up contracts for delivery to the surrounding systems. Ah, there's a job opportunity for you traders out there. Xenia is a great place for newly formed freelancer and constellation crews to learn the tricks of the trade, with the Xenia Terra and Xenia Gem runs being single jump hops. There's not a great deal of profit in helping Kovalix avoid import taxes, but it is ideal for inexperienced crews looking to find their space legs. The station's active job board is also a good place to pick up longer duration missions with higher payouts. There you go, go check out the job board. The final planet in the Baker system has no atmosphere or magnetic field, but it is home to very dense mineral deposits. Shubin Interstellar has been granted claim rights to the planet, and a mining outpost named Geo is now the planet's single feature. And we're talking about Baker 4 here, if I didn't mention that. Spacecraft can come and go from Geo, although the Shubin-constructed facilities on the planet are Spartan at best. While Baker's three inner planets may be useless in any formal sense, they have taken on new life as one of the galaxy's most dangerous unofficial racetracks. The Abel Baker Challenge, held once every 6 months on a date announced to the competitors only 24 hours before start time, pits pilots against each other and Baker's innermost planets. The challenge consists of three legs, connected by quantum travel phases that can only be initiated at specific locations. First, pilots must navigate the space that surrounds Baker 3, which is filled with dangerous ice crystals that can impair instrumentation and severely hamper visibility. The second stage is called Breathing the Vapors. This segment involves ring targets that are placed very close to Baker 2's toxic atmosphere. Pilots must navigate the course carefully to avoid hull damage. Finally, pilots must make their way to Baker 1, where the final leg is a weapons-free race. Unlike more civilized events, racers are not immediately disqualified for the destruction of an opponent's ship, although pilot kills are still forbidden. This makes for one of the most dangerous competitions in the galaxy. Navigating the course is considered a badge of honor among underground racers, although official racing teams avoid the Abel Baker Challenge for the most part. As it is an unofficial race recognized by unknown concerns, the challenge has no rules concerning weapons or other safety procedures, other than the final weapons-free stage. Especially competitive racers have been known to gun down opponents even in early race phases in order to gain an edge. Visitors should also be aware that the underground nature of the challenge has led to a significant number of casualties among amateurs. With Terra only a jump away, there tend to be far more of these amateurs than would typically be expected. Baker's inner band is littered with the destroyed remnants of freshly purchased racing ships. So there you go. There's a more exciting alternative to the Murray Cup, which I discussed last week. The Abel Baker Challenge sounds super cool. I might have to try that out someday. Although I'll definitely want to do it with a well-armed ship with good shields. Well, that is going to wrap up episode 24 of Star Citizens United. If you would like to reach me, please email me at scupodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Google Plus. Just search for Lex Starwalker and follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. Please visit the website starwalkerstudios.com, where you can find the show notes with links to the galactic guides I discussed today. You can also find my other podcasts there. Once again, I want to thank you so much for strapping in and flying with me on another episode of Star Citizens United. Until next time, I'll see you out there.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts. Please see all that Starwalker Studios has to offer at starwalkerstudios.com.